Thanks for your patience, everyone. We are a few folks short today. Sarah, we've got a couple folks out sick, and we are not quite at our full capacity as a membership. So we are down about four folks already. So we're already a small group, and it looks like we've got Steph and, of course, Kimberly in the room. I just want to double check, but we're still comfortable going ahead and going forward and sharing out the information that we've got this afternoon. Yep.
Good.
Great. Fine
by me.
Okay. Great. Well, then I will hand it over to you to just do committee member introductions.
Okay, hand it over to me. So welcome all. I call us to order officially, and I am Sarah Stevenson. I'm co-chair of PHAC, and I also work at Innovative Housing. Steph, would you like to introduce yourself? I think you're online, and then Kimberly can introduce herself since she's in person. And then we'll hand it over to Molly Rogers for the interim director's update.
Yeah, hi, this is Steph Condor, Related Northwest Affordable Housing Development, PHAC committee member. Yay.
Hi, Kimberly Horner with the Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives, PCRI, and PHAC member.
Great, thank you. And I'm sorry, I jumped over. Did we have any public testimony, Jesse, that we need to make space for?
Yeah, actually, we did have a couple of people sign up in advance, and we are having a couple other community members join us in person. So I'll share the names that we have registered, and then I'll just do a quick survey of the room after that. I've got Tom, Kay, and Michael. If those folks are in the room.
Oh, I'm Michael.
Oh, and you're Michael. Okay, great. So Tom, why don't you go ahead? You've got 3 minutes, and then we'll let Michael get settled.
Hi, this is Tom Karwacki. I'm with the University Park Neighborhood Association, chair of the Neighborhood Association. And we're welcoming the Habitat project. And what we would like to do is to have the Housing Bureau and invite the Housing Bureau to come to the Neighborhood Association and brief us and bring us along with the journey to new neighbors for the Habitat project in along the Peninsula Crossing Trail in University Park neighborhood. And particularly since we're supposed to be, as was part of the transition from the Water Bureau, we are supposed to have a seat at the table in the discussion of all of that and the design of that project. We'd like to make sure that we're part of that project. So hopefully that you can, and the director or interim director can help us move forward on that. So looking forward to doing that. And I'll leave in the chat my contact information. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. I can respond quickly to that. Happy to participate and share more information. And our staff person, Tanya Wolfersberger, would be the lead point for you. There may be a little bit of transition to our bond coordinator on some of that effort. So one of them will get back to you for sure and talk about presenting on the latest project update and introduce the team, which is a Habitat team, Proud Ground team. It's going to be affordable homeownership on that
site. Absolutely. And that was my idea. So that was good. Thanks.
Well, see, I'm glad that all aligns. Would love to hear a little bit more around some earlier conversations you may have had with Water Bureau, but we can share that.
Well, actually also with the Habitat and I mean with the Housing Bureau director. So, and the promises that were made at the city council meeting with city council blessing on that. So on the transition. So, okay, no problem. Thank you.
So just real quick, Tom, just so you understand, this project is also part of the North Northeast Housing Strategy.
And absolutely.
And we do have an oversight committee that is will be overseeing the development of this site. Or so
the Neighborhood Association needs to be part of that too, and has not been fully a part. So thanks.
You're welcome to attend any meeting. The committee's already the committee's full. And so again, I like Molly, I'm not sure what the promises were that were made around this. So maybe we could have a conversation offline about what those things were.
Okay. It's primarily just making sure we have representation and participation. That's all.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, if you'd go ahead and put your email in the chat, we'll make sure to circle up with the right staff after the meeting. Okay, I'm going to step back and hand this over to Michael. Did you sign up for public testimony?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I'm up here.
Yeah. And you have 3 minutes.
Thanks for having me. So I understand that the topic is to, discuss the housing that we have for make it more affordable for Portlanders. But I wanted to talk about some situations regarding housing and understand the different types of criteria that might be established for housing to help people that need housing that might not be able to afford it or that are either homeless. Things that I'm thinking about are potential testing for drug use and addiction type of treatments. If we're going to be housing people with taxpayer dollars and providing different types of establishments for them to reside, I think it would serve the community well as a whole if we're going to have certain criteria to be included in that, to make sure that these people that are going to be receiving these benefits have an opportunity to have access to treatment so that they can live a clean and healthy lifestyle so we can prevent them from being back on the street. Also, I think that it should be contemplated and highly considered that we work with some type of workforce management to ensure that folks are able to establish some type of constant work so that they're able to, provide for themselves as well. And they're not just reliant on handouts from the county and the city as a large. You can see on the streets that the more that we hand out things to these folks that are houseless due to different types of crises, it seems to exacerbate the problem and they seem to remain on the street. With more access to different types of drugs or other types of weapons that are on the streets today. So I just want to make sure that when we're contemplating these types of legislations for affordable housing, that we're also taking into consideration access to treatment, actually understanding what their problem is for being houseless, if it's psychosis or something else, or if it's addiction, or maybe it's coupled between the two, that we're doing our due diligence as a city to understand each individual person's issues that they have so that they can resolve them. Because if they end up in the housing and then they don't have their problems resolved, then it could be a potential to lead them to be back on the street again, which is not something that we'd want to do. Also, I'd like to understand as well, if we're going to couple in, like I mentioned, treatment centers and other types of establishments to help people get the care that they need, because I don't think that just providing housing is an equitable, manageable resource in its own. We need to have a full service for people to be able to live in an environment that is going to be sustainable so that they can be successful for their lives to come and live in dignity.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. And we had a couple other people join. Were you wanted to? Okay, great. Let's see. And was there any other folks that had joined us virtually that wanted to provide public testimony this time? Okay, seeing none. Sarah, back to you then.
Okay, then I think it is time for us to hand over to Molly Rogers for the interim director's update.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Molly Rogers. I go by she, her pronouns. I'm the interim director of the Housing Bureau. I'm happy to share with you some pretty significant updates here at the Bureau. As you all may recall, on January 1st, we changed Bureau assignments to Commissioner Rubio. And thereafter, we have been working as a service area under Economic and Community Development, along with Prosper Portland, the Bureau of Development Services, and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So this has been work that we're doing with our partner agencies as part of our service area and undergoing a two-year set of reorganizational changes that will be phased and incremental, but will result in by 2025 under a city administrator. So there's a lot of work that will be underway in this first year, but it really is starting with us doing a shared budget presentation to council as part of our service area. And you'll get an update about all that a little bit later. Shortly thereafter, our interim deputy director, Matthew Schaubold, departed PHB and ended up working. He's going to now work for the governor to COTEC and working on the housing and homelessness statewide plan. So just wanted to let folks know we have a recruitment for Matthew's previous position, which was the policy and planning manager. That recruitment is open right now and closes on March 13th. So I'd like to encourage you all to spread the word and get great applicants to come join our executive team. As you all know, we work very closely with you all and our other advisory committees to advance policies that increase racial justice in our affordable housing, but also increasing housing supply. Along those same lines, we have not put any pause on anything at this point around all of the incredible work we're doing with inclusionary housing recalibration study and a panel that we are undertaking to look at current market conditions and how that program is currently operating. We're in the middle of a major legislative session with you all that is right now is looking at one of the largest investments the state has provided in housing and homelessness of over $1 billion in the current Governor Kotek's budget and a number of other legislative bills that I believe Jesse's going to do an update a little bit later too. Wanted to also make sure you are all aware that we have a new housing liaison in Commissioner Rubio's office. Her name is Christina Gann. And she comes from the mayor's office, but before she was at the mayor's office, she was actually in the city of Seattle and has done a lot of land use and other housing and economic development work there. Her focus in the mayor's office was on housing. So she's coming in and without skipping a beat and really understanding housing supply and other issues like that. I'm hoping next PHAC we can come and she can come and introduce herself to you all. We have a number of council presentations coming up. I'm not going to go through each one. I just wanted to highlight a couple for you. We do an annual state of housing report that updates how affordable Portland is. As you are not, and will not be surprised, it continues to be out of reach for vast majority of communities of color and single parent households across the board. But that report will be coming on March 22nd. I encourage you all to come listen to that. We also have our annual North and Northeast Oversight Committee annual report happening in April. And we have also our Portland Housing Bond annual report from that oversight committee that shows the progress of the Portland Housing Bond. Just to highlight for you all that all of those projects, all but two have financially closed, and one is going to be happening here shortly, and the other one hopefully next year. And with that, seeing if anyone have any updates or questions for me.
I do have a question. Can I have a question?
Questions are for members, PIAC members? Sir, I'm not sure who's in the room. Jesse, I'll let you figure that out.
Yep, I don't think we have any questions from any members in the room. Oh, Kimberly, oh, I'm so sorry. I say that and then Kimberly has a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to get the proper spelling of the name of the liaison person. Okay. Thank you.
All right. And if there are no other questions from commissioners, then I think we can move on to budget update, if that sounds good. Thank you, Molly, for your update. And I think Leslie is going to do the budget update.
Yep, me and Angel. So if somebody can put the slides up, whoever's running the slides.
Leslie, we didn't get your slides, but I can, if you send them to me, I can.
Okay, Angel, do you have the slides?
Yes, I do. I can pull them up.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Sorry, Norma, I thought I sent them over to you.
So let's see.
Too many meetings.
Can you see it?
We see your spreadsheet.
It's a spreadsheet. It's not the PowerPoint.
Okay. While we're waiting for Angel, Nate, thanks for being here. I did see you pop in a few minutes ago. Just want to acknowledge that you're here. Thanks, sir.
I've got it, Angel. Found it. All right. Can everybody see that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. So just to give you all an overview of where we are with the budget. We submitted our budget to CBO, which is the City Budget Office, on January 26th. We have a spring bump, which is our spring budget adjustment, due next week, and that's for the current year. We are, as Molly mentioned, we are working on our budget presentation for March 24th for our joint program area for our cluster. And that we have had the determination both from the mayor. So initially the mayor said that there would be no general fund decision packages, but through the cluster and the program areas working together, commissioners could opt to submit realignments or requests. And we will not be submitting anything additional for this for next fiscal year. So this slide shows you where our budget is in comparison to the other three bureaus in our cluster. We have the largest budget, and this does not include the funds that we send over to the joint office. With those funds, it would put us closer to $300 million. And so it's one of the pieces of information that we will be utilizing in our work session in a couple of weeks. This is the amount of work that we currently are doing with 79, 78 FTE. We have 35 subrecipient contracts, 16 IGAs, and you can read this, but 1,000 plus active housing loans, over 16,000 affordable regulated units, and over 3,000 units in the pipeline. So we're, even through the pandemic, we continue to take on additional projects, additional work, additional contracts, and utilize all of the additional funds for services and not taking on not more staff. So fortunately, we're not in the same boat as some of our sister bureaus, where they hired staff with CARES money, with ARPA money. We did not, which is why our people are so tired right now. So this slide shows the 22-23 revised. So that's the blue, so that's the current year. And then the orange or brown, I'm not sure what color it shows up where you guys can see it, is the requested budget by funding source. We do have a little more money budgeted this year for the Metro bond, less for the Portland bond, less for TIF, less in federal grants. We've got a little more in the housing investment fund, less in the construction excise tax, and the buildings is the revenue we get off the buildings that we own. So that's about the same amount. Angel, you want to go on ahead and do the next few slides?
Sure. This is the breakdown of our budget based on program offers. So this is the distribution of how the money is allocated across the board. Can you show the next slide? And this is the comparison of our total budget between personnel expenditures and all materials and supplies expenditures. So here you can see how the personnel staff that Leslie was mentioning earlier, about 78 approximately FTE, but from the budget standpoint for this year is 82 FTE versus all the outflow that goes through our doors for projects and services. And basically, we are talking about 6% of the total budget is personnel. And these are the 17 program offers that we have in the Bureau with the dollars assigned to them and how the FTE is allocated across the different program offers. So the total budget is 265.4 million, excluding the joint office portion, for a total FTE of 82.
So the last thing that we're going to share is that we know that you already sent a letter that was attached to our budget submission. We would ask that our PHAC write an additional letter of support for the TIF returning resources. There was a budget note in last year, I want to say it was last year's budget, around PROSPER and PHB potentially receiving half of the returning resources, which would be about $8 million a piece for us. We're still working through that. So we would ask that you offer some support in writing. And then the second piece of that support is included in that letter is for us to do another bond or Portland bond 2.0, that's what I called it. And so we are happy to work with you on a letter. If there's folks that can put some bullet points together, then Jesse and I can work on fleshing those out to put a letter together before we go before the mayor starts processing the budget. So with that, I'm going to stop sharing and open it up for questions. Go ahead, Ms. Sarah.
Thank you. I think we wrote a letter in support of that TIF, the returning TIF funds. I think I was just going to suggest we start with that because I thought that was a pretty strongly worded letter that we submitted before. And we could maybe reaffirm some of those statements. And I also just had a question about the Portland Bond 2.0. I haven't heard, I've seen in lots of different spaces where people are talking about it. We definitely want to generate more resources, 100% in support of that. I know that some of the regional organization or voices are really pushing towards a regional bond as opposed to a city bond. Have we had discussions about that with other partners?
I'm going to let Director Rogers answer that question because she's closer to it than I am.
You know, it's going to take a multi-pronged communication approach on this. It's all, you know, we know that there's some polling that is getting funded by, I believe, Here Together. And then we have briefed Commissioner Rubio on the issues of when we have all the bond. So the Portland bond funds are going to be pretty much allocated in the next year. As you all may or may not recall, that was tied to a 7% administrative fee, which of course, if we once those projects are done, we no longer collect a fee and we have staffing challenges. The Metro bond capped it at a 5% fee, but only passed on 2.1% to the jurisdictions. So there's sort of pros and cons to either approach. Obviously we want to support either one. A regional approach addresses the fact that we have a regional housing market and other jurisdictions have built up staffing as well to do more affordable housing. There's some things we would want to work with you all. Folks are advocating one way or the other. We would love to be a part of some of those conversations so we can share our experience with either one. And see that if whatever is potentially pulled and or potent moved to the voters, we can address some of the challenges that we learned because it was the first time we did it for Portland and then first time at a regional level. So just capturing some of those lessons learned. But it seems like this could be an opportunity for us to one suggestion could be co-chair Stevenson is, you know, do we want to bring Here Together to PHAC at some point once the polling has been concluded how do we circle back with other entities? Ultimately, though, just to be clear, Commissioner Rubio and City Council are having direct conversations with Metro and President Peterson and Metro Council, and there will need to be some understanding of which jurisdiction refers to the voters first. We have been recommending, based on the fact that our projects are getting, are concluding, we're moving people in. We still see a huge need for more housing at the lowest income levels. And we see our desire to be something in 2024 so that the capacity we've built up as well as the development capacity in a lot of our partners doesn't really necessarily need to skip a beat. Is that
provide? Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, it's Welcome Home, I think, that's doing the polling. I just want to make sure that, you know, we're all having the same conversations and we're working together and not at cross purposes in any way. I see Steph's hand up also.
It's literally the same thing that you were going to say. As long as we're coordinated and we're thoughtful and we're doing polling, I think you're doing everything right, PHB. Like, that's exactly what you want to do. And, you know, I think the focus is how do you deliver and maximize housing? And it really is a function of understanding which pathway will you have the most success at the poll, right? And so I understand you know, working with both types of funding, there's pluses and minuses to both. So I don't really have a comment on that as a preference. It's more of a function of figuring out how we can get forward, given the kind of the state of affairs that the city is facing right now. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what the pathway ultimately ends up being in this poll. So be curious to see. But I think you're doing everything right.
Kimberly?
Yeah, just to sort of echo what both Sarah and Steph are mentioning, I think it's important that we really work with some of our partners to tell the story about what we're doing as affordable housing providers in making sure that we're delivering the units and doing all those things strategically that I think the public is looking for. I do have a question concerning the TIF funding, which is the tax increment financing for the audience. I know that there's a new TIF district that's going to occur in the Culley neighborhood. Can someone tell me when you think the cash flow from that will kick in? And then I have another question with regard to one of the slides that shows some of the uses for the money that PHB is receiving.
I'm going to see if maybe Angel or Chris, if you guys know some of the forecasting and the finance side that we've gotten from Prosper.
Yeah, we received that information recently. Chris, do you have that details with you?
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I am looking at the forecast. And I don't know if it's something that we want to share. I think the sort of the main takeaway is that there's a lag before we expect to start seeing cash flow. We expect that there'll be perhaps by 27, 28 a significant amount available to start funding projects. Based on the forecast, we expect that there might be about 10 million total available through 27, 28. With the remainder coming in after that. According to Tony's, I believe that it's $143.7 million over the entire period of the TIF district that is to be allocated towards affordable housing set aside.
Thank you. And for the currently existing TIF district, which I believe you call the IKIRA, is that correct? How long is their TIF funding available in that particular district? Because some of us that are in development in that particular district, including developments that currently exist, we need to know what available resources that we can tap into to help support the housing stock that's already there.
So I think there's just two ways to answer that question, Kimberly. I mean, the first is actually, when does the TIF itself sunset as a district? When we went to council a couple of years ago to maximize the indebtedness and brought in additional about $44 million towards more affordable housing to support the North and Northeast housing strategy. But that's different than when we actually put the resources out in solicitations, because we know that it's always an issue around the time. Time is of the essence in terms of meeting our housing needs and construction costs and interest rates. The short answer is that additional indebtedness is being allocated to four projects total, with the intent that those four will most likely utilize the vast majority of it. If we have any additional funds thereafter, after those four, then we would take another look and work with the North and Northeast Oversight Committee of what those any more projects could be. And I'm just going to see if Jill had any other updates around that front.
No, Molly and Kimberly, thank you so much for that question, because as Molly mentioned, we did just in 2022 put out a solicitation that used the iCura TIF as well as Metro bonds. So we are aiming to have the full iCura maximum indebtedness funds, not only you can call it awarded, but earmarked for projects that are currently in the pipeline.
And with regard to one of the slides that spoke, speaks to like economic development funds, is there, is that money available to help support any of the currently existing affordable housing developments in some of the wraparound services that I think we hear people suggesting that some of those buildings need more wraparound services and security and the like? Is the economic development fund available for that, or any of the funds that you listed available for that opportunity?
So I'll jump on that, Kimberly. The that EOI money is money that we contract over to Prosper that they use for workforce development through work systems. So no, they'll all, pretty much everything in our budget is already programmed into a program offer or into a program that we already are providing, or services that we're already providing. We are, Molly and I have had several conversations about how we can support existing buildings, and with the fact that we were unable to ask for additional resources this year from City Council, that we would need to try to figure out what we could reprogram out of our current budget in order to do anything. And so far we've not found where we could do that without cutting something else. So we're very much aware of the need for some additional funds to support some of the things that you've mentioned. And we're working to try to figure out which resource we could use in order to do that, and how we can support, because we can't just support six buildings. We've got, you know, 16,000 units in that are regulated by us. And how do we support all of our providers and not just the ones, the six preference policy buildings or the ones in Northeast Portland?
Thank you. And thank you for the budget presentation. Appreciate it.
Are we ready to move on to legislative session review? Does anyone have any final thoughts or any final questions about the budget update? Right. Hearing none, then I'm going to hand it over to Jesse to give us a legislative session review.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay. So for anybody my name is Jesse Connery, she, her pronouns. I'm a senior project planning coordinator here at the Housing Bureau. So for anybody who follows the session to any degree, knows that right now there are a lot of bills in session. In odd years in Oregon, it is the long session. So the session is about 6 months, 5 to 6 months. And there could be upwards of 2,000 bills introduced during the session to our legislators, community members, and interested folks to review and weigh in on. Can go ahead and move to the next slide. Great. So we are certainly, I'm certainly not going to talk about all of those. A couple things to note, the Bureau, the way that the city works, all of the bills are filtered through our Office of Government Relations. They then filter those out to the appropriate agencies, the bureaus, whether it touches one or, you know, four or five of them. we then also then continue to trickle it out through our subject matter or experts here at the Bureau. So currently PHB has reviewed or is in the process of reviewing and tracking just over 200 bills. There are several that are the gut and stuff, meaning that they have just sort of language that says, you know, so-and-so is supposed to study housing, and then later on someone will introduce some language change in an amendment, and the bill will change entirely. So we're keeping an eye out on those roughly 50 bills. Homeownership bills have only just begun to drop. A PHB is looking forward to reviewing those and weighing in. And as in past years, we look forward to supporting the recommendations of the Joint Task Force addressing racial disparities in homeownership. So the four on the Senate side that I wanna talk about this afternoon, starting with Senate Bill 225. This is the PAB, or Private Activity Bond, allocations through OHCS, Oregon Housing and Community Services. OHCS is the state housing agency, they have proposed a bill that would do some reallocation of existing private activity bonds to their agency for affordable housing projects. Director Rogers provided oral testimony, and the Bureau submitted a letter in support of that bill. So it did move through its first committee. Since it has a fiscal impact, it has to go to a finance committee. We're waiting for that work session and public hearing to be scheduled. We're feeling pretty good about it, but we will keep an eye out. And should we need any additional support, we'll certainly reach out to PHAC in partnership. Senate Bill 147 is particularly close to PHB, as it is needed to extend the sunset for the HOLTI program, and that's the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption. That's the program here at the Bureau where we offer a 10-year tax exemption for certain first-time homebuyer programs, or the construction of first-time homebuyers. Rather, it seems to be moving, and we're feeling pretty confident about it. Our government relations staff is feeling pretty confident about it. So we'll keep you updated on that. Senate Bill 5511, this is the funding bill, basically the budget bill, like we were just talking about the budget for PHB. This is the state version of our state housing agency's funding, is in Senate Bill 5511. They've had the agency held a lot of information sessions at the Senate, and a public hearing is going to be held, it was held on March 2nd, if I remember what day we're at today. Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Rubio testified in support of the bill. And then the last one on here is Senate Bill 131, and that would extend certain affordable housing tax credits, the sunset for certain tax credits. It also, in the same way that the holding exemption is, it's made it through its policy committee, right, where people are sort of debating the merits of it as a thing, and it's moving on to a finance committee where they will, we're hoping and watching very closely that they approve that and move it on. Next steps for all of these bills, once they move out of their committees, would be to move to the Senate floor for a vote, and then same wash, rinse, and repeat over on the House side. Any question before I go to any of the House bills? House side bills? Let's just check in really quickly. Okay, we'll definitely provide time at the end too if anything comes up. Okay. Several folks in the room, obviously some of our commissioners follow a lot of this through our membership of the Oregon Housing Alliance. House Bill 2001 was one of those blank gut stuff bills. So it went from not having anything in it to having a whole lot of things sandwiched into it. So it includes now a lot of housing, land use, and funding in it. It has Senate Bill 7, what was Senate Bill 799, sealing eviction records and some tenant protections. It's got the housing needs analysis that was formerly part of House Bill 2889. It's had multiple amendments. It's gone through really a lot of conversation. It too has passed through its policy committee, right? So it's been debated on its policy merits, and it's in Ways and Means with a work schedule scheduled. Oh, that was for sometime today. So I guess I have to go and check in to see how we've done there. House Bill, I should also note that House Bill 5019 is the funding, a tech complementary funding package that goes along with implementing House Bill 2001. HB 2984 is a bill related to commercial and housing conversions, which the city is paying some close attention to. As City Council has showing some interest in making sure that we can still implement a local policy of looking at these types of items. And then 2653, it's a tax credit for the preservation of existing affordable housing. It's being championed by our colleagues and partners over at NOAA, in addition to others. It has had a public hearing. If passed, it would provide a tax credit incentive for owners with expiring tax credit properties to continue to keep them affordable for longer duration. And then the sort of newly emerging, and as I believe also might be sandwiched into another bill, is House Bill 3414. It has some different land use variances in it. It's only been adopted recently, so the Bureau is continuing to weigh in. But it also establishes the Housing Accountability and Production Office, which is a initiative coming out of the governor's office. That is also something that we're keeping an eye on and tracking as well. All in all, I will say, related to the session, the bills that would reduce or hinder or harm tenant protections are not moving. So that's great. The bills that we want to have moving are moving. So at least at this point in the session, we're in about maybe the first third-ish with our first deadline coming up on March 17th. So if bills don't hit their particular public hearing and work session deadline, meaning they need to have either held it or have it scheduled by the 17th, then those bills won't be moving forward any longer. But so far, things are going relatively well. With that, I'll stop and see if we have the commissioners have any questions before I move on.
It was just a very thorough report, so thank you.
I had to work very hard to get the number of bills really whittled down to make sure what I wanted to share. Great. All right. Well, if there isn't anything else, we can certainly just transition over to the inclusionary housing calibration study. So, before I jump in, there's going to be a lot here, and just like I tried to do for the session, you know, recognizing, we do have, we have a little bit more time, so we'll move through that a little bit faster than I thought. So, you know, please feel free to, you know, raise hands, ask questions. Like I said, there's a lot here. There are a lot of components. My intention here is to make sure that, you know, the Bureau is bringing PHAC along in our process so that when we're ready to really, you know, engage or talk about any new direction that you are all feeling, you know, confident about kind of where we've been and what the process has looked like. So please feel free to interrupt as I kind of move along. We've got, you know, the next hour to take up. We need that. So
we'll just jump right in. Thanks, Norma. Okay, so the inclusionary housing calibration study has five primary components that we did from the outset. And that is there was an IH unit resident experience survey, right? So the intention there, you know, what is the experience of tenants living in affordable units in largely market rate buildings? That's, we worked with Portland State University on that. There's also a site utilization analysis, looking at an assessment of the 12 to 19 unit projects, kind of attempting to get some data behind what does this question look like around our folks under, you know, is there some intentional underbuilding happening to avoid inclusionary housing requirements? We did an IH program comparative analysis, researching other programs across the nation to provide sort of a look at, a brief look at the requirements, the offsites, the set asides, the incomes, what are the compliance options, what does production look like, what does the offset package look like for different programs. There is also a development prototype analysis. We've contracted with EAE to provide that for us. And, you know, really looking at what was the, or at least what is the core scope of this calibration study this time around, right? So the focus of this periodic review this time around is looking at the calibration of the offsite options, reconfiguration and home ownership. All of these were not originally calibrated when the program was first introduced and implemented back in 2016. We also want to look at assessing the full tax exemption outside the central city. So currently the way that the program works is that projects under some certain circumstances, basically if they have a built or base zone that is at 5-to-1 FAR or greater, they inside the central city, they get to access the full tax exemption, meaning it applies to the entire building. If that project, that same project is located outside the central city, it applies only to the affordable units. So this, we would be looking at expanding that or, you know, talking about what would that look like if we expanded it to the full tax exemption outside the central city. And then we need to do some sort of rent analysis, rent increase analysis. And then, of course, we needed a stakeholder work group of technical experts to join us. And so we have a group of, that includes, as Molly has said, some of our affordable housing development partners that are in the room with us today. We also have some local developers doing, you know, largely doing market rate products, representing also the construction trades, to move through those different pieces of analysis. Great. So this is the work plan. And the yellow highlight shows you where we are today. So we have moved through that resident experience survey. We've talked about the site utilization analysis. That's the 12 to 19 unit building question. We also fit there, reconfigured the work plan a little bit to be responsive to some requests from the work group. So in the January meeting, we came back to provide some information around a couple questions about, you know, how's the Bureau's program looking at unit size and comparing that to the minimum unit size at OHCS. So we provided some analysis there. And then folks were also really interested in digging down a little bit more in what the data shows around the reconfiguration program. Basically, like what is it produced, what types of units are there, how many of them are in the central city, et cetera. In February, last month, we brought the program comparative analysis, and then we held some time for some unanticipated work, again, wanting to be responsive to folks. And so we had BAE come back and just provide some updated data related to that they will be plugging into their development prototypes to make sure that our baseline feasibility was sort of on track. ahead of us, we have a meeting here in about a week and a half to go through that development prototype analysis and then start some initial discussions around brainstorming recommendations with really digging into that conversation around recommendations. Before we move on to this slide, though, I do want to note that all of this information is posted on the Inclusionary Housing Calibration Study website. So at least everything from December through February is up and available online for any of the commissioners that are interested, that aren't part of those meetings, and then for any of the community members joining us today. That's been following me around. Little pickle. I'm going to try to manage it. I think folks are pretty familiar with this slide. All in all, the preemption on inclusionary housing was repealed through Senate Bill 1533, 2016. The city went through some through a stakeholder process, program recommendations through the summer and fall, with council adopting the program in 2016 with an effective date of February 2017. Go to the next slide. What came out of that was a program, policy framework, program design that is citywide, calibrating the inclusion rates and incentives by geography. That's that inside, outside, central city piece that we talked about earlier. There is a mandatory program at 80% of the area median income with incentives intentionally targeted to reach below 60% AMI. I will note, though, that the this is all, the framework I'm talking about is all in line with state sidebars around the policy. So that's where the 80% comes in. We're also calibrated the program to prioritize units on site over the fee in lieu or providing units on site. It's a requirement for all buildings with 20 or more units. We also have some reasonable equivalency standards around size, comparable quality, bedroom composition, et cetera, and long-term affordability. So there are five compliance options, two on-site, two off-site, and then the fee in lieu. Fee in lieu is paying out with the program. You can build on-site 20% of the units at 80% MFI, 10% of the units at 60. You can also build a brand new building off-site. You can also designate the units in an existing building under certain conditions. In the sort of offset package, there are density and height bonuses. There's a construction excise tax exemption, depends on the option selected, what level that is. There are system development charge exemptions, or sorry, that should probably just say waivers. Property tax exemption, again, that is project location specific, whether it's going to apply to the affordable units or the entire building, and a parking exemption. I will note that the work group members have pushed back on including parking exemption as one of the development incentives. And so I will, as I noted for them, for reflecting this as the program was initially developed back in 2016. There's been lots of different code changes and many parking requirements actually don't exist anymore. So the value of that particular incentive is diminished, maybe non-existent. But again, just trying to reflect it as a program was developed. These are some of the other program requirements that I talked about, right? About, you know, what they essentially get at is to develop an affordable unit that more or less generally looks like a market rate unit related to its unit size, not, you know, putting all of the affordable units on one single floor, that the amenities, right, they don't have to be the same brand, but generally the same, you know, energy, you know, rating and life expectancy. The calibration study is not the first time that the Bureau has taken a look at how the policy and the program are working. In fact, right after its adoption, the Bureau went right to work to get a rolling property tax exemption cap put in place. Followed by 2018, we made some technical changes to fee in lieu. We made technical changes and expanded the property tax in the central city so that the full building was eligible. We continued to make technical program changes. We continued to get feedback from developers and folks that are working the program with us and addressing those as we can and as need to be. In 2019, though, council did approve the original funding for this specific study. However, in 2020, when the pandemic hit, City Council directed the Bureau to redistribute that funding for emergency housing and household assistance. They also extended the lower inclusion rate as part of a land use COVID response program. In 2021, that funding was reallocated and we picked that work back up to where we are today. This is just a snapshot in time of IH projects, so projects subject to IH that are either open, under construction, in permitting, or in early assistance. We have pulled out and done further disaggregating of data. There are 989 IH units in private market buildings. So we pulled out from the data any of the, you know, any of PHP's projects. And then we've also gone through and pulled out any projects that might be receiving any other subsidy. So we have nearly 1,000 affordable units in private market buildings that we would not have otherwise but for this project. All right, so I'm gonna take one moment to pause because I feel like I've been talking a lot. I'm just gonna pause before I move into the giving a summary of the individual areas of work of the study, of the calibration study, just to see if there's questions, and I see Steph's hand.
Hi there. In speaking with market rate developers, I had an opportunity just to have kind of like a one-off conversation with somebody that's not on the Inclusionary Housing Committee, by the way, it's just outside casual conversation. And the comment that struck me that they made that I thought I'd pass along is they feel like there's just been a lot of changes made and it's hard to keep up. As a developer, you know, you kind of like when you're going into your schematic design, you're basing it on whatever the right present statute is. And as those statutes change, then you have to pivot, right? But depending on where you're at in the design phase, you might not be able to. And so I think the message that I heard was a lot of changes. I know they're trying to help and that's appreciated, but there's just so much change. It's hard to keep up with it when you're in mid cycle of a project. So, you know, I guess my recommendation based on that would be, you know, hopefully this convening of the committee, we come up with some great changes, but maybe we limit it, you know, because if you look at what you shared, it's like 2017 it changed, 2018 it changed, 2019, you know what I mean? Like, let's make some big changes and stop and let the market react and work through some projects rather than every year onesie twosie it. So. That's it.
Yeah, thanks for that feedback, Steph. Sounds like some stability, some time without change. Yes.
Yeah, time without change. Wouldn't that be nice just in life in general? Let's do that.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Any other questions before we jump back in? Okay, great. All right, so I think we're gonna pick back up is, so the first piece of analysis that we brought to the work group was around, you know, wanting to check in. You know, there was a lot of interest in City Council some members of City Council in, you know, what is the experience, what is the value for a low-income tenant or lower-income tenant living in a market rate building, right? What is that experience like? So we largely drawed drew on a study that PSU had done related to the preference policy and reaching out to tenants there. So we kind of took that as a template, worked with some different folks at PSU, and sort of modeled a study for IHU's residents. They, you know, this was it was an independent study that PSU did, you know, but they wanted to see how residents were being served. They had questions around like the residents' experience, how they felt about like building and location amenities, resident demographics, their cost of living and rent burden. And then also looked around at some other jurisdictions to see if anyone else with an IH program was doing any kind of evaluation in this area of work. What they found was that they were not able to reach enough residents. We think that there's probably some work, some relationship building to do there. You know, the Housing Bureau has some long relationships with our affordable housing partners. And so, you know, the sense was that it was a little bit easier to reach out to those folks and get access to those tenants. So despite the fact that we had, you know, the PSU was using, you know, gift cards and was going to pay folks for their times and participating in both filling out a survey and then coming to a focus group, they were still unable to reach enough residents to make it a statistically relevant or sort of whatever that term is. They did see, though, by just mapping locations, that a majority of them were located in high opportunity, economically secure areas with low risk of gentrification, that the folks that they did speak to tended to be identified as female, were less likely to be disabled, elderly, have children, or be a student. They did say they were rent burdened, but a little less so. And then when the researchers went out to kind of do a sweep of seeing what are other jurisdictions doing, are they in fact evaluating the living experience of residents in IH units, and folks are not, is in short what they found. So with the, we also had BAE show up, and they've shown up in a few different increments, right? Because the mixed, or the residential and mixed-use prototype analysis is really like a big, it's a big piece of work, and so we kind of wanted to break it up a little bit to make it a little bit more digestible and also meet the timeline that BAE needed to actually carry out the work. So the first meeting they did, they showed up and they just kind of let folks know how they were approaching things. So their methodology was to review all the previous analyses, create some draft, you know, development prototypes, share those with the work group, kind of see how folks thought those were sort of sizing out if they were on the right track. They conducted their own market analysis. They did developer and stakeholder interviews, both with the folks on the work group and then folks that they reached out to independently. And then all that, you know, accumulating in the feasibility assessment. The feasibility assessment will, what it will look like is it's creating a series of pro forma development models. It'll assess residential development costs broken out by component like site prep, hard cost, soft cost, et cetera. It'll estimate some rental revenue or sale proceeds, right? Because we need to be evaluating the program in both tenures, both for sale and for rental. It'll estimate value and can calculate some residual land value. So these are the development prototypes that we're going to be looking at, proposed in both their height and form, central city and then outside central city. They've got some assumptions, right, that they're assuming that, you know, the site size is the same, that they're using the same unit mix. They're being evaluated on high, medium, and low construction costs, as well as high, medium, and low rents and sale prices, and also including some ground floor use. We talked about that. We're including some of the cost and revenue assumptions
Also that I didn't know before, right, the in addition, like system development charges, the developer fee financing, and then they'll also be looking at you know, capitalization rates, yield on cost, return on cost, internal rate of return. So after we got a lot of great feedback from the work group on BAE's approach and how things were looking there, we moved on to the site utilization analysis, the 12 to 19 unit building question. This was carried out by our colleagues at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to explore whether folks are underproducing or not maximizing their density, specifically to be avoiding IH. They looked at building permits issued for 2019, 2020, and 2021. And again, we pulled out, or they pulled out rather, the 100% affordable, you know, deed restricted units, right? So we're looking at market rate projects. The analysis, though, a caveat is that it's not factoring in other development impacts, right? So like parking and anything like that. And in the last 3 years, this section of buildings makes up less than 10% of the total housing production. So while that doesn't sound like much, we'll also note, though, that it is a bit of an increase from previous years. Most of them are being built on smaller lots in mixed-use zones. There is a small share of these buildings that are for multiple permits on the same lots or adjacent lots, right? So where you could have, you know, one site with one permit with, you know, 12 units, you know, maybe there are a few that are going in and saying, oh, well, we want, you know, three or four buildings with, you know, 12, 10 to 12 units or something like that. So in the last 3 years that they, you know, that they were looking at, 45% of the units in the 12 to 19 unit buildings were built on lots that were less than 5,000 square feet. All in all, planning summarized that avoiding IH by building below the 20 unit threshold was not really prevalent in those 3 years of permit production history. Oh, that's funny. is there one before this? Is it infinite size? Yeah, there we go. So a couple of pieces. The next two slides are the responses to a couple of work group questions. This one was related to the unit size comparison, and that's what I brought up before, but there was a question of, you know, the Housing Bureau's unit size seems maybe a little cumbersome. What would it look like if we did something different? And the request was to compare that to the standards used by OHCS. So what we found was that the OHCS standards resulted in units larger than nearly half of the market rate sized units. So their affordable units were larger than the market sized units. The IH program standards are actually less restrictive. OHCS has an option where they could apply for a variance to the minimum standard. That's a little bit, though, at odds with city code, with Portland City Code, that requires that our program have clear and objective criteria. So we would have a difficult time allowing a, you know, putting in place a variance and also being clear and objective at the same time. So it's quite the administrative burden at that place, not only for staff, but then it would also take up additional time for that project in securing its final permits. And, you know, again, all of the things considered, you know, staff's analysis found that, you know, at least the OHCS standard was not an effective measure for ensuring that our IH units were comparable in size to the market rate units. So that wasn't to say, to close down the conversation for the work group and saying, you know, maybe there's another option, but at least staff felt pretty strongly that using the OHCS model in particular was not our best path forward.
The second piece that the work group members asked that we bring back was to kind of dig into how reconfiguration is being used. So that's through the offsite option, or I mean, the onsite options rather. So for folks that are less familiar, reconfiguration allows a developer to work with staff. Thank you so much. Calculate your inclusionary housing obligation, essentially count the number of bedrooms you would be required to provide, and then reconfigure those into fewer units with more bedrooms. So say, for example, that your project was required to provide 9 one-bedroom units. You think of it as you could reconfigure those into 3 three-bedroom units. There's some other standards and whatnot around that that I'm not going to get into at the moment, but essentially that is what the option allows. It was an option that was included at City Council as an amendment, and its intention was to increase the number of family-sized affordable units in the city. And the most recent piece of work that we took to the work group was a program comparative analysis. We started out looking at, kicking off our work from all of the hard due diligence that Grounded Solutions has done. There is no sort of national clearinghouse or government requirement to report, any findings or anything about these particular types of programs or policies. But Grounded Solution gave it a good go. And so using their map and their underlying data, we got to have a snapshot into the over 1,000 inclusionary housing programs in effect across the country. From there, we started to, filter it out by mandatory programs requiring units regardless of tenure. From there, we wanted to select programs that had relatively some similar set aside rates, had a variety of implementation dates, so that we could kind of see what programs look like over time. Many of them have had similar reassessments, such as the one that we're doing right now. So we came down to 9 programs plus Portland's program. All of them seem to have relatively similar set-aside rates, comparable income thresholds, and somewhat lower incentive offset packages. Those are both financial and in the development sense. While each of the programs require units as sort of the base requirement, providing units on site. Not all of them use units as the policy trigger. So for example, the Chicago case study, their policy trigger is actually receiving city funding or city land dedications. Long-term affordability is really prevalent. It's also really common to have different incomes based on tenure. So, different for rental and home ownership. Density bonus is the most common incentive that's offered across the programs, and that's actually the same nationally. And each of the programs requires some level of development standard, right? Usually a proportional unit mix and disallowing to put all of the affordable units on the same floor. So the next 2 slides are kind of a lot to look at. So if you have an extra screen, please feel free to zoom in and you all will be able to have access to this a little bit later on. And like I said, the full memo of this is on our website. So just give you a snapshot of the jurisdictions that we used in the comparative analysis. And this first slide is looking at just the sort of general program structures, right? What's the trigger? What does the set aside look like? What kind of income limits are we talking about? And what's the duration? And it really varies, right? Yes, there are several in there that are 20. However, Montgomery County, if you build, 11 to 19 units, you don't have to provide units, but you do have to pay a fee.
In Washington, D.C., the trigger is 10 or more units, or if you increase your floor area 50% or more, et cetera. LA County is 5 or more units. That was one of the lowest that I saw in my research. Quite the variety of set-asides. If you do take a look at the memo, I think it's kind of interesting that some of the set-asides are a range based on geography. So whether it's a sort of a higher income area or a lower income area generally, high market area, low market area, everyone uses a little bit different terminology. Some of the programs actually have, you have to provide all three types of set-asides, a 30-year units at 80, a third at 60, and a third at 30, or something like that, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then this last one, again, also lots more detail than I usually like to provide on a slide, but I wanted folks to be able to sort of access it quickly and easily later on if you so desired. So this is about the compliance and the incentive summary, right? So what are the options? How can someone apply with one of these programs? What does that offset package look like? And then what kind of development standards or reasonable equivalency do they need to provide for the units themselves? So on-site obviously is like across the board. But one's of note that Portland does not offer, just to highlight, is rehabilitation, preservation. New York calls out conversions specifically. There are several that offer some type of combination. So whether that's a combination of providing units on-site, providing them off-site, providing units somewhere, plus paying a fee in lieu. It's kind of interesting. And then when you're looking through the sort of development incentive list, again, you'll see like density is kind of across the board. Heightened parking exemptions show up a little bit. But that financial piece is one that we're going back to dig into a little bit more. Some members of the work group have asked for a little bit more on the financial offset section. So I will be coming back to the group looking at both voluntary and mandatory programs and who's offering what type of incentives at what level. So whether that's fee waivers, tax relief, or some type of direct subsidy, or what I would include in the financial. And that's it. So, Steph, I don't know if your hand is up from before or if you have another question.
Oh, dang, from before. Sorry. I just wanted to keep my hand up there. I'll get rid of it. Sorry.
no problem. So I did go through all of that really quickly. I realized there's really a lot of information. We'll actually go and grab the website and throw that in the chat because I didn't do that before. But yeah, I just want to make some space to see if anybody has any questions.
Hey, Jesse, I'm wondering whether maybe you can summarize a little bit around we're in input gathering mode, and full on prototype, wonky understanding project feasibility analysis. What sort of comes next once the panel concludes, and how do we maybe describe a little bit of the next steps of how do we look at potential changes to the program?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Molly, for that prompt. Like Molly said, right, in March, we'll be digging deep into some details. April, we'll come back and be looking for a set of recommendations from the work group, which staff will then, take back, digest, discuss, talk with our commissioner in charge, with Commissioner Rubio. And then we'll want to embark on some type of additional public engagement on what those look like and what our processes look like. However, anything that is, the Bureau or the Commissioner is interested in pursuing will have some type of
set of draft recommendations, proposed recommendations, public hearing, and vote. It just sort of will depend on the set of recommendations itself and which body those go to. So what I mean by that is there are certain, you know, program administrative rulemaking changes that the Bureau can do internally. So PHB would be, you know, putting a draft out there for public feedback, and then we would host a public hearing, take all that testimony, digest it, respond to it, incorporate it, decide not to incorporate it, et cetera. If it's a change related to the zoning code or city, any other type of city code, then those changes we will be drafting in partnership with planning and sustainability, and then facilitating those through the legislative process with the new planning commission, where it would also have a public hearing and vote. Then it would all go to city council, where it would also have a public hearing and a vote before anything would be implemented. So while we may be, you know, getting close to concluding our work with the work group, the work around the calibration study is not yet complete. And I think, you know, we'll definitely be coming back to PHAC also once that work concludes to further engage in conversation here and get thoughts, feedback, some direction. Is there anything, Molly, you feel like I missed out on that? Nope. Okay, cool.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse, for all that work and for the whole group. I appreciate your update and I appreciate all the work everyone's putting into this. It's, in my opinion, it's such a well-conceived program, and we've tried, just FYI, like IHI has tried several times to work with for-profit developers to help do some of the alternative housing options. And it's been confusing and not as clear and not easy to even figure out the economics of that. And I know Steph has a lot of good insights around that as well. So, you know, I appreciate you guys taking a hard look at it and, you know, running it through some actual case studies to see how it's really working is a great way to do that.
Yeah. And we've heard that. We've heard that in the work group, heard that before the work group, for sure. So definitely getting that on the list of things to keep discussing.
Okay, does anyone have any other questions or comments about the IH calibration study or anything else? We're getting close to possibly signing off and being a little bit early. I don't want to rush us to close, but I also don't want to hold us up here. Okay, I'm hearing that it's 4:35 and we should like to conclude our meeting. So thank you everyone and have a lovely afternoon.
Thanks all.
Bye.